Good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. I'm Sarah Mendelson, Director of the Human Rights and Security Initiative, and also a senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program. It's our great pleasure to have you all with us to welcome Edward Lucas here for the publication of his, in celebration of the publication of his new book, The New Cold War. Policymakers in the United States and Europe need to calibrate their approach to Russia based on where Russia is today politically, rather than where we wanted Russia to be when the Soviet Union collapsed. Okay, so that's the easy part. I think on that we can all agree. I think we probably can agree that Putin's Russia is not the Soviet Union. And right after that, agreement stops. And what we hope to do today is have a rather provocative discussion. And I think you're going to find that all of us are somewhere along the spectrum of trying to decide whether there's a threat coming from Russia, and if so, what is it and what can be done about it. We're going to, after a few comments from me, we're going to hear first from Janusz Bogajski and then from Andrew Cutchins, and then we're going to hear from the star himself, Edward. And by about 5:40, we hope to go to Q&A from you, and we hope to have a lively discussion. As moderator, I will step in if I feel the heat rising too much. I think that, or not enough. I think we can agree to disagree, but there's no food to be thrown in this meeting. We do hope to end by about 6:20, 6:25. We think that's about the cocktail hour, and by that point we'll be standing between you and a glass of wine. At which point we hope to have many books for you to purchase. We understand that the books are on their way.
The books are here, the seller isn't,
so that would put us in a sort of odd position of either giving them away or pocketing the money ourselves. But I think that if you were watching CNN or maybe the BBC and you were going to get a kind of very brief overview of what this book argues, it might follow something along the following lines. That in Russia, under President Putin, Russia has been increasingly in disregard of Western norms, a variety of Western norms. Generally, the outside world, usually meaning some form of the United States and Europe, have failed to notice. We have trouble walking and talking, chewing gum at the same time, and we have been rather absorbed by other issues. In fact, the war on terror, as the Bush administration has termed it, meant that the shrinking political space in Russia went almost, not entirely, but almost largely ignored. And what is going on in Russia, inside Russia, is in fact a restoration based on a rewriting of history and a encouragement of Soviet nostalgia. Our own, the way at least the Bush administration has pursued in cooperation with various European powers in counterterrorism, including issues relating to indefinite detention and torture, have complicated greatly our ability to engage with Russia or criticize if we see human rights abuses going on inside of Russia. And so far, most of this is all documented in the book. Russia has been really good at dividing and conquering the West and various international organizations, figuring out our weakness, which tends to lean towards, I'd say, greed and money. Greed is good. But also, I think, a point that comes through in the book, and I would certainly say in research I've done, is the ambivalence that many appear to, even policymakers, have for Western values, that there is a kind of talk about human rights and democracy, but sometimes it erodes at the policy level. So the way in which to respond to what is what Edward calls the new Cold War and the threat coming from Russia is a recommitting to our own values and a repairing of damage that has been done to them. And I would even maybe go a little bit further and say that if we don't do that, that within the next 10 years, Russia, along with some other powers, can essentially reset the table on a variety of human rights issues. And we need to be aware of that. And here is probably the most controversial part in the book, I would say. It's where he argues that we need to be clear, the people in the Kremlin mean us harm, and that this is, in a sense, a new sort of Cold War. I'm sure that there are various ways that I've perhaps done some injustice to the CNN version of the book, but that, for those of you who have not had a chance to read it yet, who were not at Politics and Prose yesterday buying it, that gives you a bit of an overview. And now I'm going to turn to Janusz, who I think is going to pose some questions. Do you want to speak from there?
Can I?
Sure. And then we'll go to Andy.
Okay, thanks very much, Sarah. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm going to be very brief and generally positive. I think this is a very timely book that does draw attention to the new look Russia and how I believe it does menace its neighbors and undermines both American and European interests in the post-Cold War era. Definitions are things that I don't think anybody's really accepted what era we are in. I called it Cold Peace when I published a book 4 years ago. Edward has now upgraded it to a Cold War, but you know, that's a question of debate, which of course impinges on exactly what we mean by that conflict, that struggle. Instead of listing all the things that I agree with, I'm going to take issue with one point and then pose three questions for Edward. And my point of contestation is really concerns this question of the new ideology or the new ideological struggle between Russia and the West. On page 14, Edward, you state, quote, "The ideological conflict of the new Cold War is between lawless Russian nationalism and law-governed Western multilateralism." Aside from the point that Russia is now questioning the legality of American EU action over Kosovo, of course, Russia is very selective in terms of what it considers legal. I wouldn't necessarily define Russia as classically nationalist as much as statist and expansionist on a sort of multinational basis. Secondly, though, I would really call it sort of state expansionism led by what I would define as a Czechistocracy that has actually outlived communism and has fused political and economic interests to, where possible, combat Western interests, where those Western interests restrict their own expansionist interests. And on the other hand, I don't think it's a two-way ideological struggle. In other words, I don't think the West is really engaged in the same way as it was during the Cold War, which is clearly Russia or Soviet Union had a clear ideology. I don't see a clear ideological struggle because we're not engaged. We don't explain what Russia is up to. I don't think we fully understand the interests that are threatened, that are undermined by Putin and post-Putin Russia. So in that sense, I would question that notion of a new ideological war, new ideological struggle. Maybe you could answer that as well. The three questions I have, quite brief, actually. One regards foreign policy, one regards Russian society, and one regards regarding economics. With regard to Russian foreign policy, how would you answer those analysts and policymakers that claim that we are not witnessing the revival of Russian imperialism, but really the expansion, and I hate this word, but it's used often, of pragmatic economic interests by a small group of power holders? In other words, this question of Russia Inc., a small clique with personal ambitions rather than state ambitions, with whom the West can on certain occasions cooperate. How would you answer that particular charge or observation, policy observation? Secondly, with regard to Russian society, you cite various opinion polls showing enormous support for Putin even while political freedoms are being extinguished, which I think is absolutely right. But how would you explain this, what I would call a sort of mutton mentality? Is there some differentiation by age, by region, by generation, by ethnicity, by political position, by economic position? In other words, we took it for granted that the young generation in Russia would be more pro-Western, it would be more liberal, it would be more tolerant, more open to the outside world, and yet the opposite seems to be happening. How would you explain that? And my last question concerns economics. Some would say that every state has its mafia, but you know, in Russia, the mafia has its state. The question is, how long will this last? Do you see a struggle for power and resources now that Putin is taking a back seat or maybe a side seat? Is this a struggle that will fracture this new elite, this new Czechistocracy? Will it generate instability? In other words, how long will this system survive? Because from the outside, we tend to see it as constantly rising, and that's the impression, obviously, they're trying to create. But clearly underneath, and I don't expect you to know everything that's going on in the Kremlin, but from your observations, do you see a power struggle that could basically fracture that political edifice that they've established over the past 8 years? I think I'll stop there.
Thanks, Sarah, and everybody for coming, and especially Ed, for coming out here to promote his book. Not surprisingly, my perspective is a little different from Janusz's, if anyone who has heard me speak before. I think that, in principle, I mean, Ed does a useful thing for readers in depicting in considerable detail and quite accurately many of the deficiencies of the current Russian government system, some of the ideology behind it, how aspects of his foreign policy are perceived as threatening. The problem, though, for me with the book is that the conclusions that you reach, to me, seem to be hyperbolic. Sometimes the policy prescriptions either misconceived or incoherent to me. But I think the premise of the book is what I have a problem with, that this idea of the new Cold War. And I suppose that I am one of these people who you, on page 3, who claim to be Russia experts, who view this analogy as exaggerated, senselessly provocative, or historically illiterate. Yeah, I do think that on all scores. And actually, you go through a couple of pages to explain why it's probably accurate to think so. Now, I'll say that if I were living in Riga or Tallinn or Tbilisi or Warsaw, I may have a different perspective on my Russian neighbor. And I think the urgency and the notion of the new Cold War would hold more water with me, I suppose, given the rather unpleasant history I've experienced with my big neighbor, etc. But I think to broadly reach that conclusion is not really helpful. And I think in a number of your points, where you point out things, you take it to such an extent that to me it really undermines the credibility of the argument and the objectivity that you're bringing to it as an analyst, analytically. And in fact, I don't really see it as objective. You know, when essentially you describe international business involved with Russia as a fifth column, fellow travelers, Judas-like traitors. I mean, it's really quite inflammatory language that, to me, is just, you know, not at all helpful and also inaccurate. I don't think we're in a new Cold War with Russia for a number of reasons that I won't go into that I've said before. But, I mean, Ed, in your narrative, anyone who doesn't agree with you is either stupid, i.e. they're being duped, or they're simply greedy and they were bought off. Now, I don't particularly consider myself excessively stupid or greedy. If I were, I would have chosen another profession a long time ago. Trust me. And yet I really don't share your conclusions. The book is kind of set up almost as a morality play, as good versus evil. And the Russia which you described today is just evil, to put it in a word. And as Sarah alluded to, you say we are facing people who want to harm us, frustrate us, weaken us. And that is the principal driver of current day Russia. And I just don't accept that. I suppose, while I don't think that we're in a new Cold War now, if we were to operate on the assumptions which you use and your analysis and your policy prescriptions, we would be in a new Cold War quite quickly, very quickly. Some of the points in the book I find a little hard to follow. For example, your point about the Yeltsin period. And to me, this is an example where I think you take a very good point that, you know, the Kremlin propaganda and the myth of the 1990s that all was bad, et cetera, and causing instability. You know, we shouldn't buy that myth. And of course, that's right. I completely agree with you. But, you know, then for you to say it is hard to imagine a Russian leader who could have done better, that's what you say on page 30 about Mr. Yeltsin. It's hard to imagine a Russian leader who could have done better. Well, you know, I very much agree with the point that you make that the Soviet legacy was an extremely heavy weight, and whatever was going to happen was going to be difficult. And I wrote about this nearly 20 years ago, and things would get worse before they got better. But, you know, I think we need to acknowledge that there were certain decisions that Mr. Yeltsin took which made things worse and not better, and you could imagine things being better. You know, the decision to listen to his Minister of Defense, Pavel Grachev, on the eve of the First Chechen War, to accept the advice that, you know, this could be done in 3 hours, and to go ahead and invade Chechnya. Well, I think that would have been a decision that Mr. Yeltsin had decided otherwise probably would have been better. Or, you know, you describe Mr. Gerashenko accurately, quoting Jeffrey Sachs as the worst central banker in the history of mankind. Maybe appointing somebody else might have been better. You know, loans for shares, again, something you don't go over in the book, which I think was a dreadful mistake on the part of the Yeltsin administration, you know, probably could have done better. Or how about the kinds of relations that Mr. Yeltsin had with the legislative branch? Could he have taken a different course that might have had a different outcome? I think so. I mean, if I were, you know, in retrospect, I think the answer was to call for elections back in the fall of 1991. But I think there are other ways of resolving that situation than ending up where we were, with the parliament being bombed in the fall of 1993, and the new constitution which emerged from that. And in fact, the new constitution, probably we could have emerged with a better constitution than what we saw in December of 1993. So the point is that, you know, certainly policy matters. And to simply kind of conclude while the current narrative, which is popular about Mr. Yeltsin, is inaccurate, I think the sort of position that you've taken on him is also inaccurate. In a kind of an analogous way, the point about history, which is very well taken and very worrisome, some of the directions in which Russian history is being rewritten, or at least the directions which is being encouraged by the Kremlin. I share those concerns with you and Sarah and a number of others. But your point gets, I think, really hurt then when you go so far to say that, you know, we don't want to, obviously we don't want to whitewash Stalin's crimes and Stalin's atrocities. No, we don't want to whitewash the Stalin's foreign policy after World War II, which, you know, was the greatest contributor to the Cold War, in my view, and I'm sure yours as well. But then you also say that on page 108, that this one I was really kind of shocked to read, that it ignores the fact that the Second World War was largely Stalin's fault. The Second World War, largely Stalin's fault. Huh. As I recall, it was Mr. Hitler and the Germans that bombed Great Britain and attacked Western Europe and also attacked the Soviet Union. And you go on to say, if he had not connived with Hitler in the 1930s, Nazi Germany would not have been able to attack. Oh, you think that Mr. Hitler would not have attacked? I don't know. That's a really, really dubious point, Ed, and kind of make that, you can say a lot of bad things about Stalinist Russia, but, you know, causing World War II, I think that is really way over the top and just invites needless criticism, and I think it undermines your objectivity as the author. Energy issues. The two chapters on energy and security, there are a lot of things that are just downright inaccurate. I mean, this is a book that could have used a lot of editing, proofreading. I mean, there are a number of things that are just, you know, either they're silly, sort of silly mistakes, like referring to Pemex as the Brazilian company. Pemex, Mexico, it's a Mexican company. Novatek, or you refer to Novatek being taken over by Gazprom. Okay, well, last year, Gazprom bought 19.9% of Novatek, and Novatek remains an independent company. But I suppose it's the the way you contrast in particular Nord Stream and Nabucco. Nord Stream, in which you quote the Polish defense minister, Mr. Sikorski, and comparing it to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Wow, that's a pretty inflammatory description of a pipeline, which in effect is going to deliver energy to our allies, including the country which you live in, I believe. And to suggest that, you know, Nord Stream is a really, really evil project, virtually the way you describe it, is sort of a morality play, and pretty much only driven by political interests, not those of market interests or commercial interests. And then to contrast that with a description of Nabucco, arguing that we should, that we should be strongly following the promoting the Nabucco project. Now, but what is a project actually which has, you know, less support in the marketplace and commercially, Nord Stream or Nabucco? You know, I think it's Nabucco, but to not even suggest, I know you're shaking your head, Keith, but there's no gas there for Nabucco. At any rate, I mean, the description yes, certainly the Kremlin, Russian policy is driven, and especially energy policy, to bilateral relationships, and to achieve its interests. Now, but is that evil, as you pretty much describe? I don't think so. Then, or for example, the way you describe the Stockman deal. Sorry if I'm going on here a bit, but
remember,
I will conclude in a couple minutes. I know. Stockman, quote, "This was probably the worst deal a big energy company has ever had to accept from a resource-rich country." Well, which energy company had to accept it? They chose to accept it, and several energy companies chose not to. Chevron backed out of Stockman. They weren't interested in those terms. ExxonMobil pretty much backed out quite a while ago. I mean, you know, they made a calculation as to what they thought was in their interest. They didn't have to do that, but that's the way it's described. The security chapter, I was kind of interested how you referred to these rumors persist that Russia not only supplied Iraq with weapons of mass destruction, but also moved them out via Syria before the American attack. So when was Russia supporting Iraq with weapons of mass destruction? This is after the 91 war, when UNSCOM was inspecting the, I don't know, it's not footnoted. You also make a similar allegation about Iran that's not footnoted. Foreign direct investment. I know, sir, I'm getting to the end here, but Ed, you kind of got my dander up. I'm sorry if I'm not being as concise or coherent as I should be, but it'll give you more to respond to. You state that since Putin started criticizing America publicly in 2003, foreign investment has soared. Okay, foreign investment since 2003 has soared. Is it because America has been criticizing Russia? I don't think so. You know, I think it's because of the macroeconomic conditions in Russia improved tremendously since then, primarily due to the improvement of economic conditions as a result of the oil price spike. No relationship whatsoever, so I don't know what your point is there. But then you point to Prime Minister Tony Blair's warning that foreign businesses should take more account of the political risks in Russia, which came just before an investment summit in St. Petersburg attended by a record number of corporate chiefs. So, do you think that Tony Blair actually knows more about economic and political economic risk than CEOs of companies who are actually making real investments? What's the point there? All right, finally, I'll wrap this up, and I apologize for being tendentious, but I found the book in parts tendentious. You know, the policy recommendations. Absolutely agree. Page 2008, recognize that Russia is an authoritarian state. Fine. And, you know, treat it like another authoritarian state like China or Kazakhstan. Okay, fine. You know, don't have these illusory hopes that Russia is going to become part of the, you know, part of the European community. Okay, fine. I'm good with that. Let's recognize reality. But then what is the reality of those prescriptions? Well, in effect, it almost comes down to sort of boycotting boycotting Gazprom and Rosneft. You know, I mean, I think, Ed, to take your policy prescriptions for Russia, you know, if we were to apply those across the board, then what are we going to do? Are we going to boycott not only Russia, but are we going to boycott China, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, a number of other countries that we don't particularly like some of their domestic practices? No, they don't. They don't quite comply to our standards of a free society. Therefore, you can't have any kind of market relations with them. I mean, that is the conclusion which I reach from reading your book. Like I said, I think if you based a policy on, if you undertook a policy on that basis, while we don't have a Cold War today, we would have one in the future. Thanks for your pitch.
Well, we promised controversy, or at least a lively debate, and we're very lucky to have an Oxford-trained debater. So we'll go to you.
Sorry, I'm going to resist the temptation to speak extremely fast in order to get all my points across, which is my natural response. And first of all, I'm really glad to have some controversy, because at most of the launch events we've had for this book so far, people have come up to me and said, "Mr. Lucas, you are very good, but you are too naive about Russia." Usually people with heritage from Eastern Europe. So it's really good to have some controversy. And thanks for that. I'm going to try quickly to rebut some of the factual points and contentions are made, and then go into some other themes. And I think, to be fair, you are quoting slightly selectively from the book at several places, and other points I've perhaps not made myself sufficiently clear. One very big point I'm making is I'm not demanding or suggesting a boycott of Russia. This is absolutely not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that Western financial markets cannot be open to all comers, just in the way that the Western financial system, the Western banking system, is not open to all comers. Now, if you cast your mind back 20 years ago, it was, or 25 years or 30 years ago, it was still pretty much possible to turn up at a bank with a suitcase full of money and open a bank account and pay it in. And that was regarded as sort of unchangeable fact. That's just the way banks are. You can't stand between a bank and their money. And we did change that through the OECD. We had the Financial Action Task Force. I would certainly not say we've abolished money laundering, but we've certainly made it a bit more difficult. And I'm saying that we should apply the same sort of rules to the big financial markets, that you're welcome to come if you're a real company. But if you are some kind of weird parastatal entity, the gas division of Kremlin Inc. or the oil division of Kremlin Inc., if you do not have any coherent explanation for your related party transactions, Rosuk, Energo, and these other things, if you can't explain who your beneficial ownership is, then sorry, you cannot come and list your shares and raise bonds. And I find it really remarkable if you had people turning up in London with a suitcase full of stolen Fabergé eggs and saying, "I need a bank, a law firm, and a PR company who's going to help me," people would call security. Turn up with a stolen oil company, and nobody even bats an eyelid. On the point about FDI, the point I was trying to make there, evidently not clearly enough, was that British business chiefs were rebuking Blair very bluntly. I think the word they used was hysterical. He was giving warning, maybe rightly, maybe wrongly, about the way in which Russia was going, at the same time as the elite of British business was coming to, as I see it, kowtow in the Kremlin in the hope of getting good business deals. And I'm afraid it reminded me a little bit of the way communist trade unionists used to go to Moscow during the Cold War to meet Brezhnev and be patted on the back and told they were doing their bit for the international workers' movement. And I do think there's a moral dimension to this. If you run your society on the belief that only money matters, then you're defenceless when people attack you using money. And that is, I think, is a moral point, and I don't feel any embarrassment about making it. On the question of these rumours of weapons of mass destruction, I raise this really in order to make a different point, that it is wrong to see Russia as the mastermind of some global anti-Western conspiracy. And there's been a lot of talk about a world without the West and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And the point I actually am trying to make in that chapter is that neither the Chinese option nor the Muslim option has any credibility. And I quote with great force, I hope, and I'm glad to see he's here in the the audience, Andrei Pionkovsky's point that an alliance between Russia and China is like an alliance between a rabbit and a boa constrictor, with Russia as the rabbit. And so I'm actually trying to knock down these rumours that one hears sometimes in the more excitable circles in the West, that Russia is everything that goes wrong in the world is masterminded by Russia, and I put WMD in that category, although I do think it's worrying. We should be worried about the sale of advanced weapons technology such as the Shkval. I don't see any reason why it's in anyone's interest to sell the Shkval to China, the Russians sell the Shkval to China or to Iran. This is a serious technology which undermines Russia's claim to be a force towards global stability, but I'm happy to hear contrary views on that. Energy security. Energy security is national security. It is not a purely commercial decision, and I make no apology for the contrast I draw between Nabucco and Nord Stream. I find it shocking that the German government was able to go in with former Stasi colonel Matthias Warnig, Putin's friend from his days in East Germany, and have this energy project, which was launched pretty much in secret, over the heads of the Poles. Now, Radek Sikorski now says that he didn't compare it to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, but certainly reports at the time said he did. And certainly, if you are in Eastern Europe, and this is my first really big point in answer, it may not look like a new Cold War from Washington. You have a lot of other problems. But believe me, if you live in the Baltic states now, you feel you're in something like West Berlin. You are exposed and indefensible and under threat, and bad things are happening all around you, and you don't know who your friends are anymore. And that is the reality. And I certainly am not saying the new Cold War is the kind of existential global military conflict that it was in the past one. But even people who choose their words perhaps more cautiously than economist journalists do will admit that there's a sharp strategic conflict in Eastern Europe. Very senior people at the State Department have coined the phrase swing states for countries in Eastern Europe whose destiny is once again up for grabs. Countries that we thought perhaps 3 or 4 years ago were firmly within a Euro-Atlantic orientation, developing its strong institutions, no great need to worry about, say, Latvia, say, Bulgaria. Not anymore. These countries are attracting high-level scrutiny in the West, in Brussels and in Washington, because things are not going in our way. Just getting back to energy again, energy, collective security is about loyalty, and loyalty has to some extent a moral value. And if we are trying to present a united front on Europe in energy, which everybody's signed up to, if countries then turn around and strike their own bilateral energy deals with Gazprom, there is an element of deceit in that. And I think that's reprehensible. It deserves to be criticised. You know, we are ending up with an energy free-for-all in which Europe, which is so much bigger, so much stronger, so much freer, so much more attractive than Russia, is being divided and in fact ruled in the energy sphere by Gazprom, because Gazprom uses its actually quite weak negotiating position so effectively. So I don't concede anything on that. I'm sorry about Pemex. That was a bad mistake, and I will change it. And I'm also sorry that footnotes 44 and 45 in Chapter 3 are the wrong way around, which is very embarrassing, because it means that I'm attributing something to Sarah that was not right. And the study I quote was not from the Carnegie Endowment. I just downloaded it from their website, but it is actually from the CSIS. And I'm very glad that the book is selling so fast that we're going to reprint very quickly, and we will correct all these errors. And if you spot any more, please email me or just put a message on the website. On the question of history, again, the quote is slightly selective. I go on from that point to say, and first of all, I do think the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact laid the basis for the Second World War. If Hitler had not felt secure in the East, he would not have been able to concentrate his forces as he did in the West. Now, I'm not saying that Stalin was uniquely guilty here, and certainly Britain with Munich has a very heavy moral burden to bear, but the fact is that the two dictators did get together. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was the death certificate for the Baltic states and for Poland, and it's to me outrageous and shameful. This is now being resurrected as a legal, as if it was a legal document. Since this book was printed, I mentioned, I think it just happened before we went to press, there was the first reference in mainstream Russian media to Katyn. It was in Rossiyskaya Gazeta, which I footnote in the book, had an article in, I think, September, saying that Katyn had actually been done by the Germans, not by the Russians. Now, that, to me, epitomised the Stalinist combination of the crime and then the lie. You do something bad, and then you pretend it was someone else. And that was solemnly buried in 1990 under Gorbachev. And that was a great moment. It meant even the British Foreign Office had to admit that it had been, that there was no more controversy. Now, since then, there have been four mentions, not in Zavtra, not in some kind of fringe, four mentions in mainstream Russian media arguing that Katyn was not done by the NKVD, but done by the Nazis. And this historical revisionism, I think, is... It is ideological, it's profound, and it's threatening. And but quickly want to mention on Yeltsin, I'm certainly not saying everything Yeltsin did was right. I mean, I intended to be very critical of him. I don't know whether maybe my wonderful American publishers missed out those pages, but I certainly recall saying that he introduced the fatal virus of election rigging into Russian politics, and I criticised him very strongly for that. I think the point I was trying to make, and evidently not clear enough, was that in 1991, the Russian economy was in such a mess that I don't think any sequence of policies would have made a difference. I don't think there was really any, whether you'd privatised first, then liberalised, then done something else. I mean, it was in such a mess. And Yegor Gaidar, in his excellent new book, Come Out Over the Road from Brookings, I think explains very clearly what a fantastic mess the Soviets had left. And it's quite an interesting thought experiment just to imagine what would happen if Yeltsin had inherited Putin's art price and all the work, the reform and institutions that had been built up and all the events in the 1990s. And if Putin had tried to take over at the time that Yeltsin did, we'd be regarding them very different. Now, have I got five more minutes? Or am I? Okay. Now, I'm just going to finish up with a little kind of thought experiment to try and explain where I'm coming from. I want you to imagine that the Second World War did not end with Hitler's defeat, with Germany's defeat on the battlefield and Hitler's suicide. Imagine it had ended in a stalemate. And that the Third Reich had carried on under a kind of German Khrushchev and a kind of German Brezhnev for many more decades. And it had ended up with a reform Nazi, let's call him Mikhail Gorbach, who comes to when the Third Reich's really pretty much hit a dead end. The coal price is low, the economy is on its last legs, there's all sorts of demographic and health problems. And he comes in, he tries to reform Nazism. And he says some pretty bad things happened in the 1930s, and we really have to fess up to this Holocaust business. That was really bad. And you know what? The incorporation of Poland and Denmark and Holland and Bohemia into the Third Reich was really, it was pretty indefensible. We should give them some autonomy. And imagine that then he fails. There's a failed putsch, and he goes down. And we get a kind of we get a new sort of Germany called the German Federation. And it's very shambolic. It has a really tough time during the 1990s. But those countries, Poland, Bohemia, the Czech Republic, Holland, Denmark, and others, declare independence, and they return to the family of nations. And we might say, hang on, we have to support the new German Federation, we have to be show some understanding, you don't get rid of totalitarianism just like that, and so on, and things would rub along. And then I want you to imagine that in 1999, an SS colonel called Voldemar Pushnik suddenly becomes prime minister. And he introduces stability, and the coal price goes shooting up, and this new German Federation, which is very strategically important in Europe, becomes stable and quite prosperous. And okay, so he closes down the independent media, and you know the political elections become sham, and state institutions are hollowed out, but still we're pretty glad because it's stable, and we have to deal with Germany, it's an important country. And we think, well, this SS, you know, the SS was really pretty bad in the 1930s. They did some bad things, you know. But on the other hand, Colonel Pushnik was in the Foreign Intelligence Service of the SS, and, you know, they weren't directly involved in any atrocities, and they were the brightest and the best, you know, and he speaks foreign languages, and certainly the German people love him. Now, okay, just imagine that. Okay, we'd feel pretty squeamish about that. We might feel, you know, we're making some moral compromises, we would like a more, you know, wouldn't it be nice if they had, what's that German word, Vergangenheitsbewältigung, and then sadly there's not any of that going on. But we would kind of put up with it, and we would probably tell the Poles and the Danes and the Dutch and the Czechs, don't be jumpy, stop rocking the boat, don't get all upset about this, because, you know, ultimately, you know, the German Federation is really important, actually a bit more important than you are. And things would be, and we would have pretty much maybe what we had in about 2001, 2002. But then imagine that Colonel Pushnik, Oberst Pushnik, formerly of the SS, starts saying, you know what, the Munich Treaty, when we incorporated Czechoslovakia into the Reich, that was actually legal by the standards of the time, and I see no reason to apologise. Imagine he said that the Anschluss was legal. And imagine that in a state-owned German newspaper, you started reading that there'd be no gas chambers at Auschwitz. And that's why the East Europeans get antsy. And that's why, however far away it may seem from here, I think it is a new Cold War, and it's about values and it's about history. Now, questions?
I'd like to see hands, and I'll keep a list running. In the meantime, you know, every country has history and parts of history, grave human rights abuses that the country doesn't reconcile with. This is the burden of society in a lot of ways. But it is, I mean, I'm very concerned about the way in which, for example, young people in Russia are being encouraged to think about Stalin, and I think the line you have, if Stalin made mistakes, so what? Lots of people make mistakes. And in fact, we do find that a majority of young people think that Stalin did more good than bad. So my question to you is, why do you think it is we have such an imprecise understanding of when societies and leaders in particular are rewriting history? How much of a Rorschach test is it? I mean, what is it really telling us? Is it simply a way of consolidating power domestically, which I think you can make an argument that that's what it is fundamentally. And what should we be looking for a sign that it's something more? I mean, I take your point about countries that are in the EU and NATO who are concerned about the rewriting of history.
Right.
And I think their NATO and EU status does put them in a slightly different position than perhaps you were suggesting. But what should we be looking for? Well, or have you already said it? Is it simply, you know, the comments in a German newspaper?
Well, if I have said it, I'll say it again. And so I didn't answer Janusz's three excellent questions. In fact, what you're doing is reiterating the second one. I think if you're really optimistic, you can make the argument that they're just crooks. This is all about money. And all this nationalist, hooey, sovereign democracy, all this stuff is simply just a cynical political ploy in order to justify redividing, you know, the Nadadielitsa, the redividing the spoils from the 1990s. I don't quite think that explains it, because they're not acting solely in their commercial interest. I must say, I love the phrase Czechistocracy, and I may try and get it into the second edition, Janusz. I think that's really, really, really excellent. I'll footnote it to Sarah. I mean, to you. Did we get it wrong?
No.
Yeah, many do, but I think we got that one right. Though we did manage to cut talk to the Giertych for the Polish education minister. My American copy editor decided it didn't look right, so they changed it to Dietrich instead. But yes, this paradox, I think it's certainly having an effect, and it resonates on different levels. And I think the one thing that we do not sufficiently realise, perhaps sometimes as outsiders, is the lasting trauma of the 1990s. And, you know, trying to explain to people that this is, you know, it's a combination of the Great Depression and the aftermath of the American Civil War all at once. And I think after that, there's, you know, the even though people seemed, you know, sometimes to outside eyes astonishingly stoical and cheerful at the time, people used to come back from Russia and say, isn't it incredible, all these changes, and, you know, life's just going on, and, you know, that incredible Russian patience. Well, actually, there was a kind of delayed action bomb, in a way, and it's made people give Putin a lot of credit for things that perhaps aren't really his own work, but are just coincidental. On the economy, which that leads onto naturally, I mean, it hasn't been that great a success, and I strongly recommend Anders Aslan's work on this, and an excellent piece whose name now escapes me, in a journal whose name escapes me, on the Putin economic miracle. I think it was in Foreign Affairs. It was Mike McFall's piece on how you really benchmark this success. And there's some big problems. The oil and gas production is flat or falling. Gazprom has, with the possible exception of Zapoljarnoye, has not brought a major gas field on stream In its history, there's a huge dependence on imported Turkmen gas, and we have no real idea what state the Turkmen gas reserves are in. So, I mean, in a way, I feel that I wouldn't want to be Mr. Medvedev or Mr. Putin taking over now. They probably had the good 8 years, and now inflation's going up. The trillion-dollar investment program that's planned is A, risks being inflationary, and B, there seems to be a real institutional problem in spending large sums of money in Russia without it being stolen. And I think someone mentioned earlier the way in which the default, or maybe it was another meeting, the way in which the you try and spend money on modernizing the military and it ends up with the generals buying 7 series BMWs. So there's this kind of astonishing leakage that goes on, which makes the modernization of infrastructure and public services, which is sort of mostly promised but not delivered, very difficult. And the feuds, I mean, this is fascinating. We are actually back to criminology. I mean, a few years back, criminology was like knowing how to operate a telex machine. Some people here may not know what a telex machine was. It was a sort of low-bandwidth, hard-wired, point-to-point messaging system, sort of predecessor of email. And people like me used to know how to type on these machines, and paper tape would come out, then you'd feed it in, and somehow your story would get to London. And yeah, it seemed that criminology was, along with flint axes, telex machines, slide rules, and carbon paper, a sort of dead discipline. Now it's back. You know, we are scrutinising for these little clues about what does it mean. You know, what is, you know, who does Medvedev represent? Is Sechin up or down? What about Surkov? You know, Medvedev doesn't like Surkov, doesn't like Sechin. Surkov doesn't like Sechin either. So, you know, who's who? We are at sea, and I think that that's a fundamental, where I'll stop there. It's a great illustration of where Putinism has got us. We have an election which is both totally predictable and totally mystifying. It's totally predictable. We know who's going to win. It's totally mystifying because we have no idea what it means.
Right, you've heard a lot of provocative thoughts and questions. Anybody want to follow up on them? Push our speakers further?
Hostile questions first, please.
This never happens in Washington. It can't be that no one has a question.
Keith, come.
Yeah. We'll take you and then you. And we have microphones. So if you can wait till it comes and identify who you are, please.
Okay. My name is Keith Smith. Question is Europe and the response in Europe, and I have the impression that a lot of the problems, the aggressiveness in the new Putin era is really a response to perceived weakness on the part of Europe. The Europe is seen as weak, as divided, as not able to respond to more aggressive either economic or political policies of the Kremlin, and that just encourages it to go on. The question is, I don't see any from a distance, although I'm in Europe a lot, any kind of attempt by the Europeans to come together to kind of push back a little bit and force Russia to kind of deal with Europe as a real partner rather than a patsy. This partner than patsy, I think, is part of the problem, and I question if what would stir Europe into doing anything. I mean, Russia has just announced a big increase in its defense spending over the next few years. Europe continues to reduce its defense spending at the same time, which will encourage people in the Kremlin to think that Europe is continuing to be the patsy that can be pushed around. The question is, what do you recommend? I mean, is there anything that can be done? Because pushing back, I mean, I suspect that pushing back on the part of Europe will have some response and modify a lot of the more aggressive, pernicious policies of the Kremlin.
Yeah, and I make some recommendations in the book, and I don't think that they're as outrageous or as dramatic as has been suggested. And one thing I think is really clear is that we have to suspend Russia from the Council of Europe, because we suspended Belarus in 1996 after one rigged election and a bit of intimidation of the opposition. We now have, not only we have rigged elections in Russia and remarkable restrictions on the media, we have again the psychiatric incarceration of dissidents on multiple occasions. with very little that and there's a guy just been sent to the psychiatric hospital in Tver. His family still don't know where he is. Larissa Arat was in for 40 days in Murmansk, with enormous efforts to get her out. And there are other cases as well. People have been monitoring this and trying to do it. Russia cocking a snook at judgments from the European Court of Human Rights. And I think, I'm all in favour of pragmatic engagement, but some of this is about values. And the Council of Europe is, for better or worse, is the kind of club of European... I hesitate to use the word democracies, because North Korea calls itself a democracy, but it's the club of countries that believe in law-governed political freedom.
Can I ask one question? Yeah. If Russia were excluded from the Council of Europe, wouldn't that then automatically mean that Russian citizens wouldn't have access to the European Court of Human Rights, which has been the main way in which European... or in which Russian citizens have... I mean, it's a question, but...
I think it's... We just have to draw a line somewhere, and it's... it's this pretend... This is a farce, and it's gone on for too long, that everything's okay. Your question about Europe, I think things are getting... I mean, the long, slow rally has begun. I'll give you one very good example, which I don't think anybody's reported, or so this is a kind of world exclusive. Unless you read the Estonian press. But when Estonia joined Schengen, they had the right to add names to the Schengen blacklist, which is mostly kind of, narcotics people and so on. Has this been in the press already? Okay, sorry, I obviously haven't read. But it may be new to some of you, so I'm still going to say. And so the Estonians gave the names of the leaders of Nashi. And suddenly these golden youth of the Russian political elite couldn't get Schengen visas anymore. That was a sign of European soft power actually working. Now, it may be coincident that Nashi was closed down about 2 weeks later, which was quite odd, because I thought it was meant to be an authentic political movement, but somehow they turned the power off and it wasn't there anymore. But things are beginning. When they tried to turn over the Nashi attack on the Swedish ambassador's car, that really woke people up. And I think what's really interesting to me is that public opinion in Europe is swinging very sharply against the Kremlin. Germany, this is on the Johnson list a few weeks ago, it's a Pew Research study. 2001, 70% approval rating for Putin and Russia in Germany. Now I think it's 23%. Well done, Czechists. That's repeated everywhere, all over Europe. The standing of Russia has gone plummeting down. I think the elites have yet to catch up, whether because of naivety, greed, or just bureaucratic inertia, I don't know.
Thank you. My name is Ryan Miller with the Center for European Policy Analysis. There seems to be a lot of cautious optimism about Medvedev's nomination or Medvedev's probable election to be Russia's next president. And there's some people in the West, both within government and the business community, which view it as a positive step towards openness, transparency. And that sort of thing. So I'm just curious as to whether you think Medvedev's rise to power represents whether it strengthens or weakens your argument, and why not?
I'd like to hear the colleagues.
Are you turning it to us?
I've got some views, but I think I'd like to know what...
My first response is answer Claudia, ask later. The magic eight ball. Who will be the leader of Russia, and what does it mean? The idea that... this is somebody who was anointed by the president and absent Putin had no real either people or credibility, I think is somewhat disturbing. I have heard a provocative argument, I think Andy heard it as well, that we should, in fact, Western policymakers should address Mr. Medvedev as if he were, in fact, an independent entity and try and bring him into... a Western community of democracies and not treat him as a Putin lackey. And whether or not that has some, if you get a taste of power, will he change?
Well, I agree with Ed. What's really striking about this Russian election is that we have 100% certainty that Mr. 99.99999% certainty that Mr. Medvedev, unless something happens to him, and you didn't hear me say that, between now and March 2nd, will be the next president of the Russian Federation. But we can say nothing with certitude about what will be the relationship between Mr. Putin and Mr. Medvedev as they go about ruling Russia. So what I will say now is purely speculation. One, I would beware of underestimating Mr. Medvedev as an independent political actor, or his possibility to emerge as an independent political actor. I think a lot of us underestimated Mr. Putin 8 years ago in that regard, including some of his kingmakers. If Mr. Putin wanted to remain president, the easiest way to do that would have been simply to amend the Constitution and remain president. So if he really wanted to rule Russia and be clear about that, that was the way to do it. That he's not doing that suggests to me that actually maybe that's not what he ultimately wants to do. And maybe he's actually becoming prime minister as a way to help Medvedev consolidate power, but he's not sure as to how Mr. Medvedev's going to be able to do in managing all the complicated bulldogs fighting under the rug in the Kremlin. And so he's kind of hedging his bets, and he's sticking around. And if Medvedev does well, then he can fade off into history and have a more normal life. And if he doesn't, then he can come back. But who knows?
If I can just add, I hope nobody looks into his eyes too closely. But rather looks at other things that are happening. I think the timing of this selection is very good, the selection is very good. Or let's say it comes at a very telling moment, because the sort of confrontation between the United States and European Union and Russia is rising as a result of Kosovo, as a result of several other issues. The question is Medvedev going to be a character who, in the old Leninist terminology, two steps forward, one step back? Is he going to take one step back, or is he going to try and reassert some kind of credibility or some sort of posture on his part that he too is a credible Russian, strong, credible Russian leader who's not dependent on Putin? Remember when Putin came in during this whole Chechen attack on Chechnya, he came in with, I'm going to strengthen Russia, I'm going to eliminate these separatists. So is Medvedev going to come in now using this Kosovo question, several other issues that are brewing between between the West and Russia, to prove his credentials? Nobody knows, but I would imagine, if I was to bet, I would say yes.
What makes me, if I were to be cautiously optimistic, it has nothing to do with the personalities. It has to do with the structural constraints that Russia faces for its development into the future, and that Vladimir was lucky that he happened to be the president of the Russian Federation, where he benefited from if you go back to 1998, for nearly 10x increase in oil prices, from the end of 2003, 3-4x increase in oil prices, which created an economic windfall. Now you can argue about some of the how well he did with some of those about his policies, but for whoever is president from now on, as Ed suggested, the economic growth is going to be more hard to come by, and unless we are expecting an increase in oil prices up to $200 a barrel, the external environment is going to be more complicated. We are looking at the possibility of certainly a tighter credit market internationally. And the kinds of challenges that the Russian Federation faces, beginning with, first of all, making the right policy moves to maintain, if not grow, their oil and gas production, to rebuild the infrastructure of the country, to deal with the demographic challenges and the health challenges that they face. I mean, this is a very large list, which should keep them reasonably busy for the next generation or so. But you can't always bet on Russia or anybody to act in a rational way, and what we think is rational. But especially when I look at the way that Putin and Medvedev have framed their recent remarks, all of the emphasis is on the social, economic, and development needs of the country for now and for the near future. And that's why primarily I don't see Russia as that great of a threat, because they have so many challenges internally to deal with.
Could I be very brief on Medvedev, but I'd love to know what Andrei Piontkovsky thinks, as he's here.
Andrei Piontkovsky, Hudson Institute. On the issue of Medvedev, I invite all you on next Monday at Hudson Institute at 10 o'clock. I am talking on the subject, Will There Be a Soul? Will be the Medvedev soul. But now, if you give me a couple of minutes, I would like to make a remark on the basic discussion. And I try to reconcile unreconcilable the positions of my two friends, Andy and Edwards. And I would suggest a new term for it, a Potemkin Cold War. I think what Mr. Putin is waging against the West is a Potemkin Cold War directed basically for internal consumption. Well, I am not young man, I remember Soviet time. Believe me, never the level of anti-Western propaganda was so fierce, so inflammatory as now. And at the same time, there were no practical hot type confrontation between Russian and the West. All the so-called conflicts on the agenda, Kosovo, IBM, and the conflicts of choice, of propaganda choice. Kosovo, we have 100 of Kosovos in the world, and IBM, maybe American plan is not very clever idea, but in any case, it doesn't represent any threat to Russian deterrent. So my point is that this Potemkin Cold War threatens more to Russia than to her neighbors, because certainly it poisoned the mentality of Russian people. You can see it on all opinion polls, because 24/7 TV anti-Western propaganda certainly getting results, and it's very sad, because to my conviction, even now when all three of us agree that Russia is an authoritarian state, period, friend Andranik will not agree. This
is, in a second, you're going to pass in the microphone. So.
Yes, a rather semantic. But I still think that we should think in Moscow and Washington now not about character of Russian regime. It's more or less clear. And it can be changed only from inside by Russian democratic forces, if such forces still exist. But we should think about our strategic operation. The strategic operation was very efficient between Roosevelt, United States, and Stalin, Russia. And I think the same situation now, we face the similar challenges, Islamic radicalism and rising China. Thank you for quoting my remark. And one of the mysteries, it's my final point in this remark, why Mr. Putin, who was so efficient in 2001 and 2002, grasping this strategic truth that our interests coincide, basically, and providing support to American operations, he solved, without losing one soldier, a very important security problem for Russia. And now he is indulging in most ferocious anti-Western propaganda. So, well, it's a Potemkin Cold War, but nevertheless, it's dangerous for future of Russia and for future of our strategic alliance, which we both need.
Yes, that's a great idea for the title of the second edition.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. You know, 18 years ago, I gave a seminar in this hall. That was the high time of Russian perestroika, Soviet perestroika, and I never heard such hostile attitudes towards Soviet Union and communist regime as I now heard here, listening Edward Lucas. You know what reminded me of this? We have a saying in Russia now. We remember 70s or even 60s, and we say that I haven't read Solzhenitsyn, but I have something to say. I haven't read your book, but you know what reminded me? Your presentation and the idea which I got listening Andy. You know, we had this kind of Kremlin propagandists, Koryonov and Zhukov, and they usually presented this kind of approach towards the United States and the West, that blacks are lynched in streets, laborers were, you know, exploited until the last, you know, I don't know, place. And this country, listening and following Mr. Guess Hall, is coming closer and closer to the revolution. This primitive approach was, in a way, you know, responded by more accurate and more stereoscopic vision, which at that time, being on KGB blacklist and sitting in special storage area in Russia, in libraries, I read in American professors' books. They had wider, more smart, and more, you know, and more adequate might be approach even to the Soviet totalitarian regime than one can hear now. Just proving, not following what quoted Andy, because you said he selectively quoted your book, I would like to show how selectively you are composing your presentation. Right. You know, I'm going to quote not Putin, Medvedev, or somebody else. I'm going to quote academician Sakharov. Being one of the, as me, of course, in a greater degree, as a victim of KGB, he, during his last period of life, many, many times said that the only institution which was less corrupt, more informed, positively thinking about the country and its future, that was KGB. And but that was, I am quoting Sakharov. I don't care when it was. But coming back to you, the problem is, you know, Soviet Union was not destroyed by United Nations. Soviet Union was destroyed by party members who really decided that this party is obsolete. And being a student in the 70s, and even being on KGB blacklist, I will tell you, as a witness, we really had a very serious period when we completely changed the nature of regime and nature of the country. We had, even in the 70s, formal culture, formal ideology, but, and Andrei, don't let me to say something wrong, but more respected and more prestigious were the people who really were advocates of alternative culture. And these people created preconditions for that changes which started Gorbachev, which means you can't, in that primitive black and white way, to say that KGB in 70s, 80s, or 90s was the same KGB as 20s or 30s. In this case, you could be absolutely wrong because you are speaking about different things. You can't say that Yakovlev and Gorbachev, they were Molotov or Zhdanov or, I don't know, Beria or others. Coming back to Katyn, who said that, who rejected that Katyn happened? Under Soviets and under communists, even Yakovlev, during one of the congresses, said, as a member of Politburo, as a chairman of the commission, which made the investigation, he said, yes, these officers were killed. But this is, I know that you, we have very limited time, that's why I would like to summarize what I said. You know, this approach is really Cold War approach, but this, unfortunately, approach is flourishing now, unfortunately, in this kind of places, not CSIS, because recent a couple of years ago, we discussed the book of Andrei Jack, Financial Times was more accurate and more sophisticated comparing to the book which came up from The Economist. I don't want to divide as Gazprom Europe, But, you know, it's very evident that Financial Times was more adequate.
Right. And can I respond by doing a little quiz? I'm going to read some names out. We're going to see who recognizes them. This is my way of rebutting the charge of kind of primitive anti-Russianism. Hands up who knows who these people were. Tatiana Baeva. You can't look, they'll be cheating. Tatiana Baeva, Konstantin Babitsky, Larisa Bogoraz, Vadim Deloney, Vladimir Dremluga, Viktor Feinberg, Natalia Gobanevskaya, and Pavel Litvinov. Who knows who those people were? Right. Thank you. I knew you would. Those were the founders, in a way, of the modern human rights movement. They turned up in... when was it? August 25th, 1968, on Red Square, to demonstrate against the Soviet-led invasion of Czechoslovakia, with that great slogan, "Za vašu i našu svobodu." Now, when I was writing the book, I was very interested in historiography and who gets idolized and who gets demonized. So I bet there'll be like websites and kind of, you know, books and streets named after them. And I hadn't been in Russia for, I'd left Russia in 2002. And I hadn't paid huge attention to this. It hadn't seemed so relevant. And it was really hard to find out what's happened. I was making phone calls, Googling, yes, he lives in America. I don't know what happened to him. And they'd been kind of, these people are absolute heroes. You know, these people should have squares named after them. They should be statues everywhere. And I find it very troubling that they weren't that they'd been sort of written into obscurity. And I completely reject the idea that this is primitive Cold War propaganda. It's a total misreading what I'm saying. The subtitle of the British version of this book is slightly different. It's called "How the Kremlin Menaces Russia and the West." And my quarrel is not with Russia. I'm arguing very strongly in this book, actually, that Russia belongs in the West. The Chinese option is nonsense. The Muslim option is nonsense. My problem is the Czechists. And you say there were some good KGB people. I'm sure there were. There were very honourable Nazis as well. And, I'm absolutely not painting everybody with the same brush. And there's all sorts of nuances about how things developed in the 70s and 80s, and you're quite right on Yakovlev and Gorbachev and all the rest of it. And I praise that. But the fact is that we now have people running Russia who are historically revisionist. And I don't think I can... You cannot overlook... Look what Putin says. Look at this textbook, The Guide to Russian Teachers. It's there in black and white. Look at this film that's just come out by Putin's confessor, which we write about in The Economist this week. Andrei's right. There's this extraordinary tone of anti-Western propaganda, which... And if you speak Russian or understand it... Just look at some of the stuff you can see on... No, but look on YouTube. Just look at these Nashi videos. Look at the music they use. You could look at the typefaces. Look at the visuals. This is... I'm sorry, I'm going on.
Vlad Spinov, Moldova Foundation. I think, Edward Lucas being covering... The region, Eastern European and former Soviet Union, I think he feels better what people there on the ground feels. And I think he became, through this book, I read, I should recognize that not all, but from my reading so far, I think he reflects what are the people in the region, in Eastern Europe, in former Soviet Union, think and feel about the new Russia. And I think for them, there is a new Cold War. For them, it's not like in Germany. Germany probably think that the Cold War ended when they united and they are building a new country. But for countries like Moldova, which I'm from where I am and I'm covering, the war didn't end. The Russian troops are on the ground. They created and support the separatist region. They almost own all the businesses in Moldova, and especially in the energy sector. They interfere in the elections, and they control who wins the elections, or they try to do so. So for them, the Cold War didn't end. It will end when the countries will become independent indeed, and the same would be for Georgia, and the same would be for even for Baltic states who are part of NATO and the European Union. Thank you. Thank you, Edward.
My name is David Nikuradze. I represent Georgian Broadcasting Company, Rostabito in Washington. I'd like to ask you about the territorial integrity of Russia's neighbor, Georgia. As you know, Russia plays main role in conflict resolution. At the same time, Moscow says, for example, some Russian MPs confirmed yesterday that Russia will be ready to recognize Abkhazia's and South Ossetia's independence after the Kosovo's independence. So I was wondering if you could give me any commentary on that, please. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. You may, and it may disagree, that I can't, maybe not believe, these things can't be seen purely in terms of black and white. You know, these, both Moldova and Georgia are the result of traumatic events in the early 1990s in which I think everybody could have behaved better, and one should not start off from the position that one side is 100% right and the other side is 100% wrong. I think that the level of real interest in the Kremlin in supporting independence for Abkhazia, Transnistria or South Ossetia is about zero. These are very useful sticks with which to poke the fire, and they can be rather like Nashi, they can be turned up and turned down. When they want to, they can receive someone from Tiraspol or from Suhumi in the Kremlin, make a big fuss, and when they don't feel the need, they turn the gas off and treat them just as a kind of commercial entity. It's a very good way of winding up the Georgians, and one of the worries I have, which I had quite strongly a couple of years ago and it still lingers, is that the Georgians may let themselves be provoked into doing something which will discredit them in the eyes of the West. There's been, so far, that hasn't happened, but it's always a danger when I, in the past, have heard Georgian politicians saying we will retake. They were taken away by force, and we will regain them by force. You know, that is not a wise policy. I think I could go into enormous and lengthy detail about the differences between Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and a number of people here who would find it fascinating, but perhaps another number who wouldn't. So I might just stop on that, but we could continue over drinks on that particular subject.
Let's take one or two brief questions, and then we are going to adjourn shortly.
Has the bookseller arrived?
The bookseller has arrived.
Hey, great. Right. Okay. So I just.
No, I've been keeping an eye on the bookseller and the wine, everything. We are on schedule. Okay.
Yes. Inscriptions will be available in the language of your choice.
Yeah. More importantly, is the wine arrived?
Yeah, the wine's arrived. Right.
I see, rather worryingly, one bottle of wine.
Yeah, no, there's more.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
It's not
the
chunky wine,
though. Right. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. My name is Basil Nikas. I think I take umbrage with the term Cold War for a couple of reasons. I hate to use the expression, it was so last century. This whole concept of rewriting history. What are the populations of most of the world now? Most of them have never been through the Cold War, have never seen a war. We're talking about 20 years, 30-year-olds who are subjected to the rewriting, have no experience of what happened before, and will believe this. You have it in Russia. You have it in the Middle East countries, and you have it in the United States. The Cold War was really ideologies between the United States and the West. Now we're really in a hot economic war, and it's a matter of survival and ongoing presence. So I think the concept of focusing on this issue of rewriting history and who the audience is where you need to get your attention to. Thank you.
Kathy, do you have? Yeah, Kathy, and then I'm going to take final comments.
Hi, Kathy Cosman, U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Maybe one way to think of what's going on in Russia, especially in the elite, is the encouragement of a siege mentality, both vis-a-vis the outside world, international organizations, and particularly with the Slavic portion of the population. And I think they may be turning a tiger by its tail, and they think they can control a lot more than they actually can.
One quick question. I don't want anyone to feel they weren't given a chance. Is there someone from the Russian embassy who wants to make a contribution? Yes.
Alexander Milikishvili, Monterey Institute of International Studies. I have actually a question.
Most decidedly not the Russian embassy.
I have a question actually to the entire panel, and you can pick and choose. Actually, it has to do with the divisions, if you think that there are any ideological divisions between Putin and Medvedev. And Mr. Kuchin's mentioned the speeches, the recent speeches. And upon careful examination, it is sort of clear that there is a difference between between them on a number of issues. And there is maybe false and maybe correct impression that reformers and liberals are coalescing around Medvedev, whereas Siloviki are coalescing around Putin. And I guess the more important question to ask all of you is whether you think it is possible to carry out two-person rule in the Russian Federation, which has never succeeded historically. Thank you.
Okay, do you want to do really quick, like 10 seconds, and then we go to you?
Yeah, go ahead. Well, 20, 30, 40. Anyways.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Nine, eight. Well, there are two things that I like about Medvedev. One, he's young, relatively young. He's, what, 42 years old, 43 years old. He never really served professionally in the context of the Soviet Union, worked professionally, I mean. Two, he, as far as I know, did not work with the intelligence services. You know, as far as whether he's more liberal or not more liberal than Mr. Putin, I think we'll just have, I would use, go back to the Russian phrase, poživyom, uvidim. Time will tell.
I'm highly skeptical of the idea that Mr. Medvedev is a liberal and that there are liberals that are coalescing around him. And I see this as a highly orchestrated event. But, you know, there could be surprises when things come to pass. I will just say this issue of history and how different people in different countries read both Russian and Soviet history, I think is phenomenally important. And I hope that we can have, in maybe a different kind of setting, a very focused conversation about this. Because I think it is, it's not good enough to have you speaking and you not hear, and you speaking and his not hearing. And there needs to be a very serious conversation. And trying to figure out how we do that in ways that are both respectful to those who perished in the Soviet period, but also so that we don't find ourselves essentially in a new Cold War where we're not listening to one another. I think that really is a huge burden. And I would add one name to that heroes list, Susanna Pecoraro. She was the only, she was a young woman. She's still, I believe she's still alive. She was arrested in I believe, 1953. She was part of a group of high school students who had actually resisted. They met secretly and were talking about Stalin. So of all the millions of people that were arrested and there was no evidence against them, Susanna Pecoraro and about five other high school and young university students were meeting and sharing information. And, you know, very little information about her exists. And it's, you know, I think it's worth thinking that there are people like that who young Russians could really look up to, and it would be important for people in the West to know about them as well. So, Edward, you are now standing between us and a drink, and
okay.
And you make a few comments.
Yes, well,
you.
I have a lengthy prepared statement, actually, which I'm going to read. Sorry, do you want to come back one more?
Okay, he wants to have the last.
You can have 10.
Edward,
no,
have
okay.
Go on.
Me? Okay.
This is judo, like Putin does.
You're our distinguished guest. You may have the last word. I mean, speaking of history, I mean, when I look at the look at Russia today, I mean, it actually harkens much more back to Tsarist Russia. And I think, you know, in your book, Ed, you do mention that on a number of occasions. Although, you know, naturally, since the Soviet past is closer to us, those are more reference points there. But when I look at the current day Russia, I think about its ambitions and the way it looks at the rest of the world. it seems to me that it's more in the context of Tsarist Russia. I mean, obviously it's something new, but if I were to choose between the Soviet past versus the Tsarist past, and granted, if you're a small country on Russia's border, that Tsarist history may not leave a lot of good things for you to be optimistic about. But from the standpoint of, I suppose, of thinking about, you know, global international relations and security, that does make me somewhat more optimistic.
Right. Yeah. Just very briefly on Medvedev, I think it's really useful, if you have a good filing system, to go back and look at what Putin said when he first came in, because he also talked about a lot civil society and the rule of law, dictatura zakona. It turned out to be more dictatura than zakon, but still, you know. So I'm highly sceptical about this rhetoric. I also recall, and I think there's a danger, at least, we get sucked into the kind of political dynamic of the late Gorbachev era, where we were being told we have to support Gorbachev against the hardliners, so therefore give him Lithuania. And I think we may get a sort of stage tussle where Medvedev says, look, I'm surrounded by Siloviki and Chekisti and these ghastly people, I'm really trying to do the right thing, you've got to help me, so please give me Georgia. And, you know, we've got to be really on our guard on that. But I'm going to finish up by saying, I've been doing this for a long time, and I still don't know whether I'm watching Casablanca or Gone with the Wind. Because if it's Gone with the Wind, it's scripted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody involved in Gone with the Wind, you know, Rhett Butler, Scarlett O'Hara, the lot, they knew, Medvedev and Putin, unlikely lovers, they knew what was going to happen at the end. And it was, you know, we sit on the edge of our seats in the cinema trying to work out what's going to happen. If it's Casablanca, they're making it up as they go along. And who's going to go to the airport? Who's going to shoot Major Strasser? Who will Inge go off? Ilse go off with? And we just didn't know. I just go back to it. And sometimes I think, you know, this is a really clever ploy. To bring in Medvedev, the non-Czechist, young, even smaller than Putin. Maybe there's significance in that, we don't know. If I was an ambitious dwarf, I'd be sending in my resume. Or maybe they're just sitting there thinking, what do we do? And, you know, Dima, you can do it. I don't know. And on that note, thanks very much for coming. And the book's outside, it's at a bargain price of only $20-something. We take credit cards, blah, 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 blah. Buy lots for your friends.
Let us...